It could be you. Your host, John S. I'm back in the KABF studio with you, and I'm bringing what I hope is some good news. I found out that the Listen Live link to KABF has been out of use. It's kind of had a difficulty with some of the equipment here, but I walked in earlier today, found out that the motherboard has been repaired, and Listen Live should be back up and running. So those of you who are outside of the regular listening area, well, if you're not hearing my voice, there will be a copy of this program made available. And a very quick shout out to Grace and to all of the folks who called in to let me know about what KABF means to them and what the program It Could Be You means to them as well. And a very quick shout out, and again, a belated thanks again to Carla Swanson for allowing me the time to interview her for last week. And once again, you might want to get in contact with Arkansas Time After Time. You can do so by contacting, if you want to use the 20th century methodology called pen or pencil and paper, complete with stamp and envelope. You can do that at Post Office Box 11491, Conway, Arkansas 72034. Or for faster results, you can pick up the phone and get a hold of Carla at area code 501-444-2828. 444-ATAT. There's RSOL at ArkansasTimeAfterTime.org. Make sure you spell out the word Arkansas in full. And you can also go online to ArkansasTimeAfterTime.org. And ATAT is on Facebook. It could be you hungry. It could be you homeless. It could be you facing a very great and great difficult time in your life because you or perhaps a member of your family is on, whether it's in Arkansas or someplace else, a sex offender registry. Well, Carla Swanson was here last week talking about what's been going on with sex offender laws, sex offender situations here in the state of Arkansas. But I've got someone who right now is sitting in Albuquerque, New Mexico, who is one of the top people within an organization called NARSOL. And I am very proud, very happy to welcome Larry Neely to this week's edition of It Could Be You. Larry, are you with us?
Thank you, John. Yes, I'm here today, and I really appreciate the opportunity to come in on this eve of Thanksgiving.
Okay.
And spend some time with your listening audience, and this is a very particularly difficult time as we move into the holiday season for a lot of people, and I'm just happy to share what I can in the way of positive, uplifting news for people going into the holiday season.
Fantastic. Now, one of the things that I always like for everybody to start with doing, give contact information. If someone wants to find out more about NARSOL, first of all, tell them exactly what NARSOL is and how they can get in touch with this organization.
NARSOL is the National Association for Rational Sexual Offense Laws. And we were formerly known as RSOL, and we added the National Association, and we kept the RSOL. So now we're NARSOL. And you can contact us by a variety of methods, or the 20th century and the 21st century. So we're very simply at NARSOL.org if you want to go to our website. And if you would like to contact us through sending us an email with a question or a comment, we have a couple of great gatekeepers, and we try to answer all of our inquiries. It may not be as thorough of an answer, but we respond, and you send us that at contact@narsol.org. That's contact@narsol.org. And for those who would like to contact us by mail, we also have some great volunteers. All of this is a volunteer operation. We try to respond. So you would contact us at Post Office Box 36123 Albuquerque, and that's A-L-B-U-Q-U-E-R-Q-U-E, New Mexico, abbreviated NM, and the zip is 87176.
And I know before we went on the air, you had NARSOL has like a special offer that you want to make sure that some folks here in the state know about.
We do, John. We're hoping to bring some joy to people and some good news. We have a newsletter that we send out, and through the various channels it goes out by print, it goes out by email, It goes out through core links to predominantly a population of federal incarcerated individuals, and we are hoping that we can establish some new friendships with people in Arkansas. So if you're listening in Arkansas in a correctional facility and you would like to receive our newsletter, it's called The Digest, all you have to do is write us a letter at the address that I gave, P.O. Box 36123, Albuquerque, New Mexico, and you mentioned the call letters of this station that you were listening to KAAFB.
KAABF.
Excuse me, John, but mention the call letters of this station, and we will send you a trial subscription for 6 months. And if you're already a subscriber, you receive there's a subscription form in every newsletter. If you just simply put in that referral, if you can get a subscription form from someone, we will gladly send you a trial subscription of 6 months to the newsletter.
Now, Larry, let me make sure that everybody knows about this. It doesn't have to be people who say already are, or who will be on the registry. Is this going to be something that would be available to maybe families of someone who's on the registry?
We have a lot of people who are on the newsletter list. The printed edition primarily goes out to people who are incarcerated, but we have a contingent who are not incarcerated that just simply like to read it the old-fashioned way. Mm-hmm. But there's a massive number that go out to by electronic distribution that are into the general population. So we will send them to people by print edition if that's what they prefer.
Mm-hmm.
But primarily the people who are incarcerated get the print edition.
Okay. Now, one thing, NARSOL does keep pretty good record of RSOLs, reformed sex offender law groups in the different states. Now, suppose someone's going to be listening in and they and their loved one, their relative, or someone they know and care about is not, say, right here in Arkansas, but would be in another state. They could contact NARSOL and find out if there is any sort of support or RSOL organization in that particular state. They could do that by contacting NARSOL.
That is correct. They can follow on our website. There's links to the state affiliated groups, and all states don't have full-fledged affiliates, but we have other levels of contact and advocate.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have people in the majority of the states that we can refer folks to for questions.
Mm-hmm.
So we do that when an inquiry comes in to gatekeepers. We send those inquiries out to the various states to people because theoretically they're closer to the action and have more up-to-date information. Than we do.
Mm-hmm. Now, kind of looking kind of at the big picture, the big national picture, for the last few weeks, there has been this new, this kind of sudden, or maybe boiling up until it reaches the explosion point or something like that. But all of this new, this kind of attention that's been given for sexual harassment, sexual assaults, and it's been in the news. You can't go really a day without hearing something about Roy Moore. A few days ago, you couldn't go without hearing something about Harvey Weinstein, Al Franken, so many others. Larry, from the way you and NARSOL see it, is this sudden attention, this sudden in the spotlight, do you see anything that will affect NARSOL, will affect, say, the hopes, the plans to really bring about some long overdue and much needed reform in sex offender laws?
Unfortunately, John, we do. We see it already even before this most recent batch of news. If you remember, not that far back in the distant past, well, we just had the former Speaker of the United States House of Representatives, Dennis Hastert, who had been involved in coaching young athletes. He was a high school wrestling coach prior to his political days. And there were allegations that he had abused a number of the wrestlers he had mm-hmm. coached. And as a result, we saw he was beyond the reach of prosecution for that behavior. So mm-hmm. we saw an erosion of the statute of limitations mm-hmm. in Illinois as a direct response to Hastert, and the, mm-hmm. the statute of limitations would be where we would expect many of these accusations that you're mentioning mm-hmm. or go back decades. Mm-hmm. And if there was criminality, so there's actually two things we can talk about, John. We can talk about inappropriate behavior, and we can talk about criminal behavior. Mm-hmm. Some of this stuff is just plain out inappropriate, but it's not criminal mm-hmm. In terms of what these allegations are, and some of it is, would be criminal. But mm-hmm. where we'll see the backlash will be in terms of lengthening the statute of limitations so there'll be a longer period of reach back. And then probably everybody remembers the competitive swimmer, I believe he was from Stanford, mm-hmm. that just this past summer, who had been sentenced to a very brief stint in jail and then probation.
Oh, yes.
And the California Assembly probably changed the statute as a result of that high-profile case mm-hmm. so that people who plead to that offense cannot receive what was supposedly too lenient of a sentence mm-hmm, mm-hmm. for him. So the backlash is already out there. It has been there, but we only see that it will continue to accelerate. Our fear is that the presumption of innocence will evaporate and that the statute of limitations will evaporate. And when we don't have a presumption of innocence in this nation, then our cherished values have gone overboard mm-hmm. and no one is safe from anything. And I would really like to hear some of the law enforcement people speak up about the presumption of innocence, because if you notice, when one of theirs get accused, mm-hmm. you remember the Baltimore case where they demanded that they be presumed innocent, mm-hmm. and they demanded that they get their jobs back if mm-hmm. they are found not guilty.
Well,
we don't seem to apply that same standard.
Well, there's something else going on that could add to it. You have, on so many college and university campuses as well, you've got women, usually it's the women coming forward and saying, well, I have been so-and-so, someone sexually assaulted me, someone did this without my consent, and there's been this rush to deal with it. And again, as you were saying, there are a lot of people who are accused, and this presumption of innocence has been kind of blithely tossed aside. The catchphrase now is preponderance of the evidence.
Well, unfortunately, John, that's not the standard that's required. And, of course, it's fortunate from my perspective, but that's not the standard that's required to convict a personal crime. But mm-hmm. preponderance of the evidence is just a showing slightly more than 50%. That's mm-hmm. a civil standard. Mm-hmm. That's not a criminal standard, which is beyond a reasonable doubt.
Mm.
It scares me that our nation seems to be ready to just totally dispense with the presumption of innocence, because this hot button issue, these crimes that some did occur, mm-hmm. perhaps some didn't. We know that people do make false accusations. All you have to do is remember McMartin preschool.
Plenty more besides that.
So we're rushing to judgment too quickly. But mm-hmm. I would like to see the law enforcement, the prosecution side, I would like to see them ask for the same presumptions that they demand when one of theirs were accused, mm-hmm. and that's where I think we'd be most helpful mm-hmm. if we heard them mm-hmm. speak up and say, whoa, we're going too fast here.
Mm. Well, there seems to be, you know, with ending that statute of limitations, it seems to be especially pointed, especially, say, loud, whenever it has to do with maybe a crime against a minor may have taken place or did take place. Okay, Larry, what's your take on that? You know, is this just maybe the point of the point of the spear kind of being aimed at the Constitution, do you see any kind of good coming out of all of this?
I hate to be a pessimistic person, but I believe that the good that does come will be outweighed by the bad. Mm-hmm. If we erode due process and the presumption of innocence, we will actually have some guilty people that will be convicted, but we will also have innocent people that will be convicted. Mm-hmm. So I believe that the destruction to our values will be greater than the good.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm not advocating or condoning people who have done unlawful things.
Mm-hmm.
It's just our system is not designed. The reason why we have the statute of limitations, John, is because it's impossible for anybody to defend themselves as time passes. What happens is, as time passes, evidence that's critical to a viable defense vanishes, people's memories fade, people pass away that would have been critical to that defendant's theory of the case, and flat out, people just don't recollect things. You can send a message around a room, and by the time the message circles the room, it's not even straight. And you talk about adding decades to a person's recollection.
Mm-hmm.
And there's evidence that shows that memories are fallible.
Mm-hmm.
Eyewitness testimony, even itself, is bad. So fallible. So I'm concerned that we're destroying what's made this nation great, and that's that we don't lock people up without due process, and we start with the presumption that you're innocent until proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and that seems to be evaporating right before our eyes.
Okay, well, with that in mind, what is NARSOL? What are the state reform sex offender law organizations doing to try to fight the statute of limitations? Let me start with, from what you've learned from your experience within NARSOL, what is going on now against all of this new attention, against the push to end the statute of limitations?
It varies from state to state. We have more robust groups in some states that mm-hmm. have been established and have more participation. And it's a very difficult pushback, John, because mm-hmm. you're going up against a well-organized the victims' advocates are well-funded,
mm-hmm.
and that's the primary proponent of lengthening or abolishing the statute of limitations altogether.
Mm-hmm.
So they're well-organized, and then they have the tacit support of the law enforcement apparatus because they have another angle that they're working on the law enforcement side, and that's that the evolution of forensic science in the last 20 years has been enormous.
Mm-hmm.
So what you have is a lot of cases that have been solved through forensics evolution and advances that were sitting stale and unsolved in decades past. So the victims are being told, yeah, we know who did it.
Mm-hmm.
We sure do.
Mm-hmm.
We can't do anything about it. They got away with it.
Mm-hmm.
So the lawmakers are faced with angry victims who say, well, they know who did it, but mm-hmm. there's nothing can be done about it.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a tough pushback, but we do have groups who are explaining the reasons for the statute of limitations, mm-hmm. trying to bring sanity to the mm-hmm. discussion,
mm-hmm.
but it's a tough one to push back on because we're outgunned with the resources on the other side.
Well, even with all these tremendous odds, with all the opposition, and let's add in that in the legal structure that the prosecution, the district attorney, they too are going to have a lot more access to resources and so on than, say, the accused and perhaps even the accused district defense attorney. Certainly that would be the case if the attorney for the defense was, a public defender. But what will NARSOL do in future? Will NARSOL kind of keep doing the same thing? Are you going to wait for developments to come where NARSOL can kind of plan, see what's going on, and plan an effective, say, for lack of a better word, say, a counterattack to remind people about the statute of limitations, to remind people about the rights of the accused, even if the person has been accused of a sex crime?
Well, we do all of the above, John. We
mm-hmm.
we try to provide training and support for our state groups to help them with education and,
mm-hmm.
and talking points and how to relate to their assemblies. And each assembly is different around the country.
Mm-hmm.
Some of them run very brief periods of 30 days, 60 days, and some
mm-hmm.
run
mm-hmm.
almost year-round. So it varies from state to state, but we try to provide as much support as we can,
mm-hmm.
and we try to collaborate because what's been learned in one state doesn't need to be relearned in another state.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of getting word out, we try to do what we can with our platforms to get word out, but we're we're only touching, skimming the surface, mm-hmm. because of our reach is so limited compared to the other side. You mm-hmm. just pointed out, you're hearing this every time you turn on the news. Mm-hmm. Everything on the internet is all about these old accusations. And Charlie Rose was just let go from his association with PBS and CBS.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I don't see where this is going to end. But we're mobilizing the best we can. We hope to get out a statement in the next few days about the danger of what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
But it's sad because people don't realize it could be them, and it won't necessarily be a sexual offense, but the statute of limitations could be on any type of offense.
Plus, let's add this, and I think it needs to be repeated as many times as possible until it begins to sink into a lot of brains, that the way that the sex offender laws are set up now, a person has a far better chance of winding up on a sex offender registry, being convicted of a sex offense, than say maybe their child has of being actually molested by someone.
Go ahead, John.
I was going to say that, again, look at the name of this program. It could be you. And go from there. That the way these laws are set up, someone out there, maybe right after the Thanksgiving holiday, they're going to be hit with an accusation. And the likelihood of them winding up on a sex offender registry would be much more probable, would be far likelier than actually having someone, having a child, maybe a child in your own family, molested by someone. It's just the way these crazy laws are set up.
Well, if a person is accused of a sexual offense, it's very difficult to defend because there's been a fair amount of erosion of the due process mm-hmm. already in terms of the confrontation clause, in terms of the right to aggressively cross-examine. The victim's advocates have claimed that vigorous cross-examination is re-victimizing the victim. Of course, we don't know if they're a victim until the person's been accused has been convicted.
And let's add to that the perhaps overuse of a plea bargain.
Well, the plea bargain is a result of the insurmountable odds that a person faces. If a person is going to go to trial with virtually no hope of winning, like, for example, Narsil is helping on a case in the Ninth Circuit that's mm-hmm. on appeal where the Arizona statute of sexual battery doesn't require that the touching be for sexual motivation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It requires that the person who's accused of it disprove that the touching of the intimate parts was sexually motivated.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that goes contrary to the prosecution is supposed to carry the burden of proof in every single element of an offense.
Mm-hmm.
And it totally subverts the accused right to remain silent. So they have to give up their Fifth Amendment right to remain silent and testify and explain why that they touched the person. And there could be any number of reasons for touching a person that would not be sexually motivated, but they completely relieve the prosecution of having to prove that touching was mm-hmm. with the sexual motivation mm-hmm. of the toucher or the person touched.
And you got a similar thing happening with the people on the college campuses who get accused. Now the burden of proof has been thrown onto them as well.
So we're helping with that particular case, Narsil is, mm-hmm. because we see that as an unconstitutional shifting of the burden.
Mm-hmm.
And a person... That's something that legislatures have been quite fond of doing. They've done that with drug possession.
Mm-hmm,
you could be in possession of drugs and not know that they're illegal. What if you had a teenager? What if a teenager put the drugs in your vehicle?
Mm-hmm.
And all of a sudden you got pulled over and the dog alerted on the drugs that you didn't know were there. Well, you were in possession of the drugs. but you didn't intentionally and knowingly possess the drug.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So those type of strict liability, those are referred to in legal jargon as strict liability offenses.
Mm-hmm.
And when the lawmakers make everything strict liability, well, statutory rape is another example. You can have in Michigan the famous case was Zachary Anderson, where he went and hooked up with a girl that he had met online,
mm-hmm.
and thought she was older than she was, but Michigan's law is specific in that it doesn't matter what you thought, it matters what they were.
Mm-hmm.
So he was doing what any normal teenager does growing up and trying to hook up, and then he's on the sex offender registry because of the strict liability offense scheme. There was no hope, so the reason why that case had to be pled out was because he had absolutely no chance of winning at trial because the statute mm-hmm. is constructed in such a way that there's no defense to that.
Well, now, you said the operative phrase, the statute was constructed in such a way. That again, the statute was constructed in such a way.
That is correct. So there was no overuse of the plea bargain. He had a choice of going to trial and being convicted because mm-hmm. it was a strict liability offense, or mm-hmm. he had a choice of trying to negotiate the best outcome he could by plea and taking the offense, which potentially put him on the sex offender registry. Mm-hmm. In his particular case, it didn't, because he got he ultimately was given the Homes Youthful Trainee Act, mm-hmm. which spares him from having to register, mm-hmm. my understanding.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, now, What really may strike a lot of people as really kind of unusual is the fact that despite all of this big attention, with all of this big attention going on, there have been not only victories in which Narsal played a major part, but there has been research that has been going on that even strikes hard against some of the original, if you want to call it research, that painted this absolutely bleak, dire, if you will, dangerous picture about anyone and everyone who has been convicted of a sex offense against a minor. What so many people have thought for so many years, the incredibly high recidivism rate of someone who has committed a sex crime, particularly if they happen to be one of those dirty blank 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 pedophiles. But Larry, I want you to hold that thought. I think about that for a little bit, because we're at the bottom of the hour, and I need to remind everybody that you're not only listening to KABF, but got a little bit of information to share with you. And so if you can just hang in there, we're going to be back in just a little bit. And after I bring, if I can get this CD player up and running, bring you just a little bit of information. But Larry, why don't you give contact information for Narsal while I'm waiting for this doggone CD player to work?
Sure, John. That's narsol.org online. And if you want to contact us by mail, it's Post Office Box 36123, Albuquerque, New Mexico,
mm-hmm.
87176.
Mm-hmm.
And if you want to shoot us an email, it's contact@narsal.org.
Okay. Hang in there. I think this thing is working again. But this is John S. We'll be back with the second half of It Could Be You very, very shortly. Hang in there.
With stage 3 breast cancer. So
with you for the second half of this week's It Could Be You. Larry Neely, are you still with me?
I'm still here.
Okay. I was saying before we went on break that there's been some victories that Narsal has been a part of. Would you like to talk about what those victories are, and as you see it, what they mean when it comes to sex offender reform?
Sure, John. There's been a couple of really fantastic victories. One
mm-hmm.
by the United States Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
and then one in a U.S. Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. And for those who are not familiar with the court system, the United States Supreme Court is the supreme court of the entire country.
Mm-hmm.
And then within the federal court system, there are district courts and there are courts of appeals. And we have 11 circuits the country is divided into. For example, Arkansas falls within the 8th Circuit,
mm-hmm.
and the 11 circuits. And then there's the D.C. Circuit, which actually makes 12, but there's 11 circuit mm-hmm. courts. So this circuit court of appeals out of Michigan in the case of Doe versus Snyder. So the Doe versus Snyder is probably the case that will have the most impact, although the U.S. Supreme Court case. So let's talk about Doe versus Snyder.
Right, right.
What that case was about was that after the decision in 2003 in the case of Smith versus Doe, where the U.S. Supreme Court said it is okay to have registration so long as it's a non-punitive regulatory scheme, and they mm-hmm. they opine that the Alaska scheme, as it was existing at the time, was not punitive.
And just to be clear, okay, that the registry is seen or interpreted at that time as not being punishment.
Well, that was the interpretation based on the registry as it existed
right.
at that particular
right.
time.
Mm-hmm.
So registries have been constantly evolving because the criminal justice advocates for hammering down and the victims' advocates never run out of things to recommend that be added to the registration requirement.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But at the time, that case, as it worked its way up from the state court through the federal court system to the U.S. Supreme Court,
mm-hmm.
I believe it actually was an appeal from the Supreme Court of Alaska, but I'm not sure it's been so many years, but as that case worked its way up, that was an old version of registration in effect, and they said, as we look at this, it's not punitive
mm-hmm.
because it doesn't impose any disabilities or restraints, and it doesn't mm-hmm. restrict people where they can live and work. And they went through a test that has been established since 1963 of 7 factors called the Kennedy-Mendoza-Martinez factors, and they went through those 7, and they said, we don't see it here in this scheme,
mm-hmm.
so therefore, well, the state's took that as a green light that you can do anything to people registered for a sex offender, so registered on state registry. So they've constantly encroached and added more and more.
Mm-hmm.
So there's been residency restrictions, employment restrictions, identification restrictions,
presence restrictions out in California and a few other places.
Correct. And in some states, you have to have a lettering on your driver's license that blatantly says sexual offender. And I believe in Alabama, it's orange letters.
Mm-hmm.
So they never run out of, they limit where the people can live. They can't cluster. They can't live where the apartment complex that has more than so many. I mean, it just goes on and on.
Mm-hmm.
So what Michigan,
mm-hmm.
what happened in the challenge in Michigan was they said that you went too far because you just couldn't stop yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And the various series of amendments, I believe it was in 2006 and 2008 or 2008, 2011, but
mm-hmm.
the additions that they kept piling on
mm-hmm.
transformed what was a non-punitive regulatory scheme into what was clearly a punitive registration scheme. So they held that the current version with those enhancements is unconstitutional
mm-hmm.
to be retroactively applied. So what that does for us and the advocacy is that we can look at all the states, particularly within the Sixth Circuit, and then even outside the Sixth Circuit, we can look at states where they have enhanced their registry
mm-hmm.
requirements through the
mm-hmm.
years,
mm-hmm.
and we can argue within the circuit that this is binding authority, but outside the circuit, we can argue that this is persuasive authority based
mm-hmm.
on the legal analysis, and that what may have been regulatory and civil at one time has evolved to the point it's inflicting punishment. Therefore, it's gone too far.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be that case is going to be cited quite a bit in future litigation.
Well, I hear and read about things along those lines that have been happening in, for example, Colorado and Pennsylvania. And that there have also been, particularly out in California, there have been lawsuits challenging residence restrictions in various California cities. So taken all together, how important are they and how important do you think they will be over the next, say, months and years?
Well, these two cases that I mentioned, and then you've added to it. Now, in California, you've got a unique situation because
mm-hmm.
the California Supreme Court made the proclamation that residence restrictions were unconstitutional.
Mm-hmm.
So cities are just not ready to, were not willing and ready to repeal those or,
mm-hmm.
or cease to enforce those. So it required additional litigation to get to the desired result. But it was based on the case of Henry Taylor.
Mm-hmm.
In the case of Doe versus Snyder, that Michigan Sixth Circuit case will give a lot of ammunition for future litigation, and I expect the pace of litigation to accelerate as we go forward because the U.S. Supreme Court just declined to review the case, which means that that decision is not in any jeopardy. The final ruling, when the Supreme Court declines to intervene, that is the final authority on that. So Michigan is going to have to retool its registry, and I expect that they will go as far as they can to try to impose as much punishment as they can and not cross that line, which it's not clear where the line is, but they're going to have to take also. The court was particularly concerned about all the restrictions in terms of where registrants can live and then the lack of due process because they increased the amount of time that they have to register, and they did that retroactively. So it's a moving goalpost. You don't know when you're ever going to get off because they changed the rules.
Well, let's add to that the one time recently when the Supreme Court did get involved, and that was in the Packingham case.
Sure, we were going to get to that one, and that was a case out of North Carolina, where the North Carolina Assembly had passed a law that banned all people on the registry from accessing social media, and they defined social media very broadly. And the Supreme Court, even though the North Carolina courts found no problem with that, they in their rarity, a Supreme Court granting a certiorari, petition for certiorari is very, the odds are very slim. But they granted review to that case, and they reversed the North Carolina Supreme Court, and they said you just can't impose a blanket ban on all people in the registry. And if you read the dicta, they were particularly concerned about people who paid their debt to society. Society, which is one of the arguments that Narsil makes. We've got to stop punishing people after they paid their debt to society. We believe that all the punishments imposed in the last 30 years, the United States has gotten terribly punitive and imposing some very long sentences. But if we can't stop punishing people who paid their debt to society, we can't even have a rational discussion about what the appropriate punishment is for people. So so that decision is going to be huge because it's the law of the entire land now. So the states who have blanket bans against registrants accessing social media, they're in grave jeopardy as soon as a challenge is launched because those are no longer enforceable.
Well, and I mentioned, you know, before we went on break, I mentioned that some research has come out that one of the fundamental, I guess, foundations, if you want to call it that, dealing with sex offenders, this goes back, you said going back about 30 years, okay? Go back to 1986, and there was this magazine, Psychology Today, and it came out with an article on sex offenders, and it concluded with, and I'm quoting here, frightening and high repeat offense or recidivism rates, okay? But within the last several months, the authors of that article have come out to admit that they based it on faulty and right from the get-go flawed, or in some cases even made up evidence. So a very great deal of the force, you could say, behind this mania to come up with new, more harsher sex offender laws, well, we've been lied to. And do you see that in any way, shape, or form coming to the forefront on ongoing or future legal challenges or legislative challenges to existing sex offender laws?
I do, John. I see it in both. I see it more in terms of legislative advocacy, but it is relevant in the legal arena as well. I'm one who doesn't believe that the Smith versus Doe 2003 decision was based on any of that. I believe that when you read it very carefully, they based it entirely on the Kennedy-Mendoza-Martinez test, and that was. And we don't have long enough time on this program for me to go through all those factors. But in the back of the minds of judges in the lower court levels, when these challenges have to initially be filed, they've been programmed to believe all that, and the lawmakers who make the laws, they believe all this stuff because, quite honestly, we haven't been there to educate them. We, meaning the advocates that have the good information, we haven't been there to inform them. And most of your, like, for example, in Arkansas, your legislature is a part-time. These people work regular jobs, by and large, and they don't
have...
Oh,
they do. I've seen Carla and other members of Arkansas time after time talking with members of the legislature, particularly when they're in their regular session. And Larry, you hit the nail on the head. It takes going and talking to people. And, well, Carla, she mentioned this last time, but she had to use her knowledge, her experience of her work to stop an opposition to a law saying that here in Arkansas, someone who's on the sex offender registry, you can take that person off the registry provided that he or she has died. And there were some legislators who were saying, maybe that could be, and Carla had to say, based on her work experience, and she had to literally educate the members of a Senate committee. And it was thanks to her being there and her educating them that this bill was passed. So, Larry, you hit the nail on the head with that, that people do have to be educated. But shouldn't the people, maybe whether it's registrants themselves or, say, more powerfully, family members of a registrant, okay, to educate themselves first before they start to educate others?
Well, that's absolutely critical that the advocates themselves fully understand the issues.
Mm-hmm.
To be effective, you really need to be able to understand. You don't have to agree with the other side,
mm-hmm.
but you need to fully understand where they're coming from. And that's very important for people, because there are people who believe with all their heart that the registry works.
And once a pedophile, always a pedophile, et cetera, ad nauseum.
So absolutely, but there are people out there that are reasonably intelligent that believe the registry works,
mm-hmm.
and it's the humans are in many ways gullible.
No,
Americans or whether so if you've got people you trust, mm-hmm. that wear pretty uniforms and have good slick back haircuts telling you that something's good and it keeps you safe, it's kind of like at the airport security. I'm not convinced, and I don't want to pick on the TSA because I think they have a tremendous job to do, but a lot of what they do is for show. It makes people feel good to see all of that stuff.
Yeah, and that's the phrase. That's the phrase I've heard again. Feel good laws. Feel good legislation.
So, but the next attack on, if we have a terrorist attack, it won't be through the same methods they used on 9/11.
Mm.
So we're making people feel good, and we're spending a lot of money on TSA, and I don't believe that we'll ever see another attack that'll go down that way.
Okay, so, and by comparison or contrast, okay, I've read the research, okay, that you got your sex offender registry up and running, flawed as they are, okay. But why do you have, according to the research, I'm being slightly sarcastic here, why do you have the plain and simple, verified by research, why do you have the plain and simple truth that, say, 95 to maybe 98% of all new sex crimes are committed by persons who are not, repeat, not on a sex offender registry?
Well, that I think a lot of people, even though they don't agree that the registry is effective,
mm-hmm.
they believe that. So what if 95% of the people are? What about those who might reoffend? At least we're doing our best to try to shut that door so that they can't live anonymously. The theory of the registry is mm-hmm. outing the person mm-hmm. and humiliating them with eyes of everyone on them publicly keeps them from being able to reoffend, because otherwise they would. That's a flawed theory.
Mm.
But that's the theory behind the registry, is that the more eyes that are on a person, the mm-hmm. less likely they'll have the opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
I don't agree with that, but mm-hmm. that's what the advocates come from. If we're watching them.
Well, then going back to what I asked a couple of moments ago, okay, that the people have to educate themselves. Larry, from your point of view, are there any particular publications, are there any particular websites or anything that could be a start for registrants, registrant families, people who are interested in criminal justice reform? Are there any places that maybe you or NARSOL might suggest, if not out and out recommend, as a starting point, educating yourselves before you start educating others?
Sure, there's a lot of great stuff out there. The effect of Megan's Law on sex offender reintegration,
mm-hmm.
that's over 10 years old by Jill Levinson and Leo Cotter.
Mm-hmm.
That's a great read, and it's been out there for quite some time.
Mm-hmm.
There's No Easy Answers. Mm-hmm. And I'm trying to remember who I think that was a human rights watch. They talked about the effect of the registries. That's another good one.
And I've also heard that the Department of Justice has had a publication out for some time that really shows that people who commit sex crimes, the reoffense rates are really far lower than so many people think about. So there has been that Department of Justice or Bureau of Justice paper, that research has been done. And would you say that could be considered another pretty good starting point?
Absolutely. Anytime you can use their own statistics, that's a great one. There's Understanding Collateral Consequences of Registry Laws from 2014, Justice Policy Journal. Erica Davis, Frenzel, Kendra Bowen. There's just so much out there. We all know that the recidivism rate is very low, but it's not one of the most compelling arguments you can make, because even though it's low, when you throw in the towel and concede that it's okay to violate the Constitution, if it saves one, because that's what they'll throw at you, if it saves one, it's okay. You lose that argument. It's like I give the Gatling gun analogy. If I put 100 bullets in a Gatling gun and ask you to run out 100 yards, and I tell you that of the 100, only 3 of them are live rounds, I bet you wouldn't let me shoot it at you, would you?
Well, gee, do I have a death wish today? Do I feel lucky? Have I won a lottery? I know.
So if you tell the average citizen that only 2.3% are going to reoffend, they don't want that 2.3%. So you have to stamp it out and say, we can't violate the Constitution, regardless of how wonderful the result might be. And I take the attitude that I always tell people who say, if it saves one, is it worth it? I say, well, yes, it might be. I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll go back to our hundreds of thousands of people who are having their rights obliterated by being punished after they've paid their debt to society. And I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll look them in the eye and tell them that we're going to jettison their rights if you'll jettison your constituents' rights to own firearms. Because I know if we tighten down on firearm ownership, we could at least save one. And I've not got any volunteers to meet me halfway that'll go tell their constituents that they will flush their constitutional rights if it saves one. So that's your comeback for that, because if it saves one, we can't flush the Constitution to save one.
And how was it that Benjamin Franklin put it? Those who are willing to sacrifice some of their rights for a little safety are not worthy of either the rights or the safety.
Bad paraphrasing. I can't tell you that quote, but yes, you end up with those who are willing to sacrifice liberty end up with neither. For safety, they end up with absolutely neither.
I want to kind of shift gears with you. In the time we've got left, okay, so far we've been talking about the people on the registry themselves. Now, what is so frequently overlooked has been referred to by numerous sources as collateral damage, okay? And I'm thinking of, say, the families of registrants. And even here in Arkansas, I have heard the stories of someone on the registry, they have children, and the children are being bullied by their fellow students at school. So, and this is something that doesn't really come out. And would you say as well that the collateral damage that is done to the families is something that needs to be brought up, needs to be figured into the discussion?
Absolutely, John. What you're saying is just the tip of the iceberg about the bullying at schools. Mm-hmm. You have so much collateral damage to the families, because the parents can't participate in their children's schooling. The registrant's not allowed on school property in many states, so they're shut out of their lives to go to their after school plays, to sporting events. They're shunned by their peer group in terms of they can't hang out and I remember one where he was a middle schooler here in my state got beat up because his dad was on the registry. Mm-hmm, and his dad went to the school to try to protect him. Then he got locked up for being on school grounds.
Oh, yeah.
And then,
mm-hmm.
and then lost his job. Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. it's a tragedy. And absolutely, John, that is the most one of the most powerful things you can do mm-hmm, is mm-hmm. to bring that aspect to light in your legislature. When you when you're talking about these laws, when they're wanting to pass a law that it puts a further restriction on mm-hmm. on an offender, try to imagine the unintended consequences and have people there who can talk about that. And particularly, you don't want to exploit small children, but when they get to their teenage years, they can testify quite convincingly. You bring a 14-year-old to the legislature and says, you know, my dad can't come and watch me grow up in school mm-hmm. and how that hurts me and how that I was on the cheerleading squad, but they kicked me off and none of the kids will have anything to do with me. Mm-hmm. Those are powerful things that can be done.
And I saw kind of the variation almost take place here in Arkansas. Now, something else I wanted to bring out, and this is an outgrowth partly of a call that I got last night. A woman called me from northeastern Arkansas. Thanks again for the call. And we were talking about different things related to legal reforms. And she then told me the story of, I believe it was a nephew who was on the registry here in Arkansas, but not too long ago moved to the state of Mississippi to take on a new job. And he did not know that moving from Arkansas to another state, you would have to also register in that other state. So when she found that out, she made a few frantic calls, and just literally in the nick of time, her nephew did get to the proper authorities in Mississippi and register. Okay, how about a couple of comments about that?
That is a tragedy of this situation because, John, we don't have, despite people's misconception, there's no national registry. Mm-hmm. So each state has its own registration scheme with their own offense lists that they register, with their own frequency of how often you should report and what mm-hmm. information you're required to provide. And some states give you no credit for any time you've been on the registry in another state.
Right.
So you go to another state, and you may be starting out from scratch, and the southern states, particularly Mississippi, Louisiana, and along that Gulf Coast are mm-hmm. really tough. Mm-hmm. They assess fees against the registrar. They mm-hmm. have to carry a separate ID, mm-hmm. and the penalties for violating in the South can be very harsh. You can be years in prison, and it's just a convoluted hodgepodge of all these different registration schemes around the country, and you have to give advance notice before you leave one state in many cases, so it's quite complex. And then
the complaint, the complaining question was, well, why can't registrants get that information while they're in the state where they're originally assessed, when they were originally convicted? Why can't this information about what's going on in the other states be made available?
Well, I can answer the question, and it'll sound like a sarcastic, rude answer, but the state that they're wanting to go to is not really wanting them to come. So they don't sit around with a highly staffed up office ready to explain to you what their rules are. So mm-hmm. it's very difficult. I mean, you can do some searching on the website, but mm-hmm. but there's no person sitting in the state saying, oh, well, yes, you want to come from Arkansas? Oh, yes, we would welcome you, and here's what we would require. That's the rarity when you find someone who will talk to you like that mm-hmm. because they just assume the person not come.
Mm-hmm. Because?
Well, even with the low recidivism rate, if you have 100 sex offenders from another state in your state that have no connection to your state, and the recidivism rate is only 3%, what does that mean? That means that with basically 3 sex offenses that would occur.
Ooh, not in my backyard. No, keep them away from me. No, like that.
Mm-hmm. So it's a terrible tragedy for people who are intending to comply, and just the complexity mm-hmm. prevents them from complying, and then they end up with another felony and, mm-hmm. and oftentimes a habitual enhancement on their prison incarceration.
And let's make it very, very clear that these administrative, quote unquote, administrative arrests, convictions, and so on, that inflates, you could say wrongly inflates, and kind of gives the foundation, if you want to call it that, oh, that's why they have such high reoffense rates. That's why the recidivism rates are so high, that actual reoffending of a new sex crime in so much research that I've seen, is so low, is so very, very low.
Absolutely. There are a lot of rearrests for technical violations, mm-hmm. and the registry is a technical administrative.
That's what I was looking for, yeah.
But people who are under supervision for sexual offenses, mm-hmm. there are a lot of the complexity of supervision is so significant that you can have a technical violation but mm-hmm. no new sex offense. Mm-hmm. And then they say, well, the arrest rate for people is 22%. Yeah, but it wasn't for a sex offense.
Right, right. Larry, I hate to say this, but we're just about out of time. One more time, contact information for NARSOL, and if you want to talk about that special offer that you've got going out to some folks who are listening in, how about giving that to them one more time?
So, yes, for the people who are listening in prison, I understand that there's a significant number there, John. You can write to us at NARSOL, P.O. Box 36123, Albuquerque, New Mexico, 87176, mm-hmm. and just mention that you listen to KABF, and we will be glad to send you a trial subscription. We also, I don't know if I have much time, but we will provide the digest to people that are indigent if they will just simply send us their mm-hmm. inmate banking to show that they're indigent, and we will provide that at no cost. We have a sponsor that helps us pay for that, mm-hmm. so we'll provide the digest. So
okay.
Anybody who's listening to this today, we'll send us a request, and we'll get you on the list to receive the digest newsletter.
Okay. Larry, many, many thanks for being this week's guest on It Could Be You, and I'm going to metaphorically arm twist you into coming back on in the future and talking more about NARSOL and what's going on with sex offender law reform. Thank you again.
John, delighted to be with you this afternoon.
Take care, sir. Goodbye. Okay. Well, you've heard it, and now Ed Blair is waiting very, very anxiously to get on with his usual mixture of blues and rock and the ringing of chimes, ring out wild bells, so to speak. But just very quickly, next week, good friend Dr. Gene Kennedy is scheduled to be on the phone with me, and we could be talking about criminal justice reform, particularly in light of this new visible, say, target of sexual harassment and things of that sort. It's going to be a pleasure to be able to sit down with her next week, talk about what's going on. And tomorrow being Thanksgiving, I'd better also leave you with my efforts at wit and or wisdom. Tomorrow being Thanksgiving, just remember that it may not be an insult tomorrow if someone gives you the bird. But more seriously, folks, take care of yourselves. I'll be back with you next week. And please remember that between now and next week, to be careful, because something could happen, and it could be you that it happens to. I'll be with you next week. Happy Thanksgiving.